This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.
Well, this is Patricia W. Fisher, and I'm talking to you on Thor's Day, otherwise known as Thursday. But a little nod to Chris Hemsworth there if you're listening, which we would all be so excited if you did. But here we are. We are Thursday, July 6th, and we are talking to an amazing author today. I have been able to grab from her very busy schedule, Joanne Power, who also goes by Charisse DeLance. And if you don't know about her, let me tell you a little bit. Whether the story calls for immersion in history, the always volatile corporate world, or the demanding environment of journalism, Joanne Power brings her expert writing talent to draw readers into exciting, realistic worlds. She is a master with words, whether she's writing mysteries, thrillers, good old-fashioned romance, or in the erotica world as her alter ego, Charisse DeLance. Even with the multitude of awards, this amazing woman has found the best accolades she's ever received have been from readers. She writes in her Amazon author bio that I challenge myself constantly to write books that thrill my heart, and her readers agree she is amazing. Her historical romance, Heroic Measures, tells the story of one of the over 10,000 American women who volunteered to serve in World War I. And presently, Joanne serves as the World War I curator for the National World War I Army Nurse Corps Museum. Her latest erotica book, No Getting Over You, is also available under the name Charisse DeLance. So everybody, please welcome Joanne Power. Hello, Miss Joanne.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Absolutely. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. I've known Joanne for quite a while, and she was a very good sport to me when I went to my very first RWA conference, Romance Writers of America conference. We hadn't known each other very long at that point, but every time I saw her, she was one of the writers signing books, and every time I saw her, I would scream really loud, "Oh my God, it's Joanne Power!" And I'm pretty sure I scared you a few times.
And it still does, because
you still
yell that whenever we're around, and we belong to the same Romance Writers of America chapter, and so you still say that, and it still brings a chuckle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you got to support your friends. You do.
That's right. Fandom.
So I always
great.
Ask. Right. I always ask everyone when we start an interview, what was the very first romance book you ever read?
Kathleen Woodiwiss. What was that? Probably the late 70s, which really dates me, you know. Of course, I was born yesterday, but...
Right.
No, not
but
really.
But you know what? You're not the first person to say that. You're absolutely not the first person. No.
No. I was given the book by my next door neighbor, and she said, "You have got to read this." And I was instantly hooked, and I said, "Wow, are there any more of these?" And she kept buying them and handing them over, and I kept saying, "Wow, this is really cool." So I started to I had always wanted to be a writer. In fact, I still have a little booklet I made when I was in eighth grade that says, you know, someday I'm going to be a writer. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to be a foreign correspondent. Well, that didn't happen, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
But you did have have journalism background. You are a journalist as well.
Yes, I do, and that was largely by the seat of my pants. I remembered a lot of my journalism training from high school and college, and I applied to, would you believe, I lived in Washington, so I applied to the Washington Post, and I said, "Hey, you know, I can write freelance for you." And this was back in the day when freelance actually paid something. And they said, great, what can you write? Well, I said, well, you know, I can write feature articles about people. And they said, nah, got a lot of those. And I said, okay, what else can I do? So I made a stab at a new idea. My husband was a financial planner with all the alphabet soup in back of his name. One of the first ones, actually, and I learned a lot over the dining room table. So I said, oh, I can write about financial issues for the average person. And they said, great, you're on.
Oh, wow. So, how old were you when you did that?
Wow. How old was I? I must have been 31, 32. And, yeah, which does date me now, definitely, right? But hey, you know, as we say here, I'm very healthy, and I will say I owe that to the fact that I've always written, and I've made my living doing the thing I love the best, which is writing, whether it's fiction or non. So I've had a very good life, and I hope to keep it going here for a long time. I have no reason to think I'm going anywhere anytime soon. So But so I started to write these financial issues. You know, how do you read the stock market page? Let me see. And why should everybody have life insurance? Oh, good question. You know, so I started to write that kind of thing, and actually it led me a couple of years later to a full-time job that I had for a while in a corporation, a financial services corporation in downtown Washington. And wow, did I get a lot of on-the-job training there. And Went on to do some lobbying, so it was a good experience because I was constantly writing new things, new types of things. I was writing for the president of the company and the legal chief legal officer. Oh, it was endless. And then I got into lobbying, and I had to write congressional testimony. So there's nothing more daunting than writing congressional testimony, especially about financial issues. You know, so it was interesting. And so I did that for 7 years, and then I finally sold a book. In the meantime, I was a member of the Washington chapter of Romance Writers of America, and I got to benefit from the wonderful members there, who many of whom were already published, Kathy Gillis Seidel, Nora Roberts, who else? I can't think off the top of my head of any more.
But Janet Ivanovich and Tammy Hoag were in that group?
Oh yes. Now Tammy was not a member until later on, but early on, Janet was a member. I think she may still be. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But she remains a friend of mine. So I was very fortunate to learn from a lot of these people.
And they were learning too, because RWA started in the 1980s, correct?
Yes.
And so Women's Writers of America, right.
Yes, right, which is headquartered in Houston and now is the largest writers group in the world. They started out, I believe it was about 1982, 1983, mm-hmm. which was also about the same time that I started to write and become interested in. And I was one of the founding members of Washington Romance Writers and traveled in those illustrious circles for a long time until we moved to Texas in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am speaking Texan.
There you go. It's a whole new world.
It is. It is. You know, for this East Coast gal, I live 1 mile from the local rodeo. And I said, wow, people get on those bulls without, they do.
Yeah, they do. They really, do.
It was an education, a big education. So,
with you being in, seeing a lot in the, in writing over the last, say, 20, 30 years, what have been the best changes that you've seen happen in, let's just keep it to the romance writing industry, the best changes you've seen and some you felt like have been not so great?
Well, I think the best and the most liberating for the industry as a whole, although many people questioned it when it began, was the growth of digital books toward the beginning of the year 2000. And, of course, now we see Amazon, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, Apple, all of these people online. And why was that a good thing? Because it opened up for a lot of people the possibility to write shorter and to gain publication. But it also opened up the possibility to write novels and themes and characters that what we call traditional publishing or the New York houses would just not accept before that point.
Right.
And it took them a long, them meaning New York / traditional publishing, a long time to realize that the digital world was here to stay. And given that old business dictum, lead, follower, get out of the way, they had to participate. And so now they have opened up their own thinking about what's possible. And that's been so good for the industry, good for them, because they're still here. They have found a way to prosper. And many of those publishers, Avon comes to mind, Kensington, have, and now lately I think Simon & Schuster, have found a way to publish authors whom they think might be a welcome addition to their list in digital format first. And that is a very good thing.
You're right. Right.
Yeah.
I think that adding those, it's like taking a chance on someone that, you know, let's see how they do. I like them.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you keep seeing the same authors on the shelves, and don't get me wrong, they all work really hard and their books are fabulous. But I think a new author is always a thrill for a reader. Ooh, let's see what this person did. I think it just simply opens up, you know, basically, you know, more opportunities for both sides of the book, basically.
Yes, it does. It does. And, of course, the downside of that, let me just say before I go to the downside, the reason that many people, many potential authors, flocked to the digital possibility in the 2000s was because they were very frustrated with New York. And they were very frustrated with not being able to read the kinds of books that they liked or read them in numbers. Perhaps they'd, you know, they'd get one or two paranormals that they really liked. Or perhaps they really liked time travel, but they only got one or two from all the publishers. And they said, why can't I have more of these? Or what was the big launch, the biggest popular type of genre, erotic romance. People said, why can't I have this? I don't understand. And so New York learned to listen to readers whom they had never listened to. And it was an eye-opening experience for them. They suffered a lot. the old accordion, you know, of expansion and whatever. But they finally have come to the place where they realize it's a good thing. What's the bad thing that has happened? Well, a couple of bad things have happened in the industry. In the 90s, there was a great compression of what we call distributors, and there still are distributors in the world, but not as many. And there aren't as many places where you can go and buy a book now. Even Barnes & Noble, the last big distributorship or bookstore standing, is having a difficult time surviving.
Right.
But what's going on now among the writer community that is a problem, and it is that people think writers have been told you have to have product out there, and it has to be, you have to have something new all the time, and it has to be out there quickly. So I know a lot of people who just write to produce something new every month, and they're eating their own readership, and they're putting out things that are not wonderful. They haven't thought about the novel long enough. So success is a wonderful thing, but you have to think about what indeed you're doing here once you achieve
and
it.
Why
you don't. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You yourself.
So if you're just
tuning in.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking to Joanne Power, aka Charisse DeLand, and we're talking a little bit about the publishing world right now in writing. And yeah, it is hard. I think that it's one of those things where you want to put out a really good quality product, and yet you feel the pressure of writing faster, which you don't necessarily is not better.
Right.
So I think I'd rather write a little bit slower and have an amazing book than something that feels really rushed. And people are like, I waited for this, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'd much rather have that other.
Yes,
yeah.
Because
and
then
quality.
Then,
yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Then
go ahead,
you find too that the book lasts longer. More people come to it over time. If indeed it's a really well thought out piece of fiction.
Right, and it stays with the reader longer, so they're also more likely to say their friends, you have to read this.
Right.
And speaking of something that stays with you, you wrote a book, and I was a former nurse, and so when you told me you were writing this book, I was so excited. It's called, if you haven't read it, it's called Heroic Measures, and it is about, set in World War I. Now, with everybody going to see Wonder Woman, they set it in World War I, and my understanding was they set it there because Captain America had been set in World War II, and they wanted something different. They wanted to show the difference in the wars. So let Wonder Woman stand on her own. But there were a lot of, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, wonderful women that volunteered to go to Europe and become nurses. And these were women that, we were only, 50 years away out of the Crimea War, so the birth of modern nursing was extremely young.
Yes.
And these girls worked basically on duty. I mean, you showed up and they said, okay, we're going to train you to be a nurse and go over there and, you know, start working.
Right. It was...
Yeah.
And
you went to Europe, you went... Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I started to research this book when I lived in Washington, D.C., and I had easy metro access to the National Archives and the Library of Congress. And, how, you know, it's kind of funny to look back on now, but they would say World War I, And I'd say, yes. And they'd say, okay, well, we have a little bit. We'll dig it out for you. And they would come and they would present me with cardboard boxes that they had just these are the archivists, hello, that they had just thrown stuff into. Pictures, letters, folders, enlistment records, anything you can think of. And they had just thrown these things in. If you remember what old photographs look like with the rippled edges, well, some of them were
right.
torn, you know, and some other people, mostly government, I'm sure, had taken a big black crayon and redacted part of it because, oh, God forbid anybody should know that guys got wounded in a war, you know. Let's show a picture of a happy guy in a wheelchair with his nurse. Well, you know,
right.
it was
not
kind
so
of ridiculous. Yeah. So I started to research that, and yeah, I mean, it was like digging for needles in a haystack, really. I even went to Carlisle Barracks in Pennsylvania, and they are the historical record keepers for the Army, and I drove up there from my home. And they said, World War One, nurses, huh? Yeah.
And
they gave me these things that were just thrown into boxes. It was sad. Thankfully, we have collected, we've retained more of that now. And over the years, nobody wanted. I had, you know, contacts in the industry, and I would say, hey, what do you think about a novel about World War One and an American nurse goes abroad and falls in love with a British captain? And they'd say, ah, World War One, no, not a good
idea.
Yeah,
isn't that amazing? It's
yeah.
like it was a less glamorous war. It's like it was a war.
Right. It was a war. And, you know, it is the war that really changed our perspective about the world, even though when people mm-hmm. came home, they said, oh, we're going to be isolationist again. But they weren't for very
right.
long when they saw the results of that with Hitler and Tojo. So it was great to research it and create not only a heroine who is young and adventurous and dedicated, but also to create other friends of hers and
mm-hmm.
to show, you know, that some nurses went abroad for any number of reasons. Yes, they were dedicated, but many of them wanted to see the world. You know, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen
right.
Harry? Yeah. So some of them wanted to see the world. Some of them just wanted to get out of town, so to speak, you know.
Yeah.
They'd been at home for so long, and maybe they didn't care for home too much, so they went abroad. A lot of young women spoke German because they were descendants of German immigrants, and a lot of young women spoke French from Maine and Wisconsin up there near Quebec. So a lot of these women were very useful, not just as nurses, but also as telephone girls. They called them hello girls, and they translated for the high command, General Pershing, to talk to the French forces. So they were called the hello girls.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
yeah.
a whole other story in itself.
Yeah, it is.
So
it definitely is. And, of course, a lot of these women came home and left the Army Nurse Corps because they were very upset that they had no rank and they had suffered because of it. Many of them were in charge of huge wards, and the orderlies would not obey them. And they went to their commanding officers, many of them, and said, look, you know, that orderly, that male orderly, is not obeying my orders, and men are dying, and men are suffering. And still, they had no rank, no authority, and they came home and they said, I'm leaving. In the meantime, they were paid half what an army recruit was paid, army private, and they worked 12, 24, 36 hours a day.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Kind of an unforgiving job. That. And so when they came back to home, back to the farm, were they, and generally speaking, I know you can't account for, you know, all, but were they generally well received by family members?
Oh,
or
yes.
Or do we know that part of the story? Okay.
Yes, we do. Many of them have left all kinds of records. We do have letters from many of them. They considered these women to be heroines and not renegades. Yes, they were valued and listened to. And, of course, they knew, because they had practiced some of the latest techniques in wounds and surgery and dental surgery and plastic surgery, and they were valued.
Definitely. Did a lot of them go into the medical profession when they came home?
Yes, many of them became doctors themselves. A few became plastic surgeons. Yeah, that World War One was the beginning of plastic surgery. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, and I know it really exploded after World War II as well.
Oh yeah,
so, yeah,
it did. Yeah, yeah, because we had perfected a lot of those techniques. Plus, we knew a lot more about blood transfusions. So that made plastic surgery easier.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, but I could talk to you for hours about this subject. But I would think that, you know, doing this research, it would be hard not to be distracted by the wealth of information that you obtained while doing this.
Yes, it's true. I do run a blog. It's called They Also Fought. And the information, a lot of it ancillary that I found, I tried to put up there, and I still do. My husband and I have traveled to France. He calls it one of the greatest adventures of his life, to have traveled along the American front lines. And he calls himself my translator and my bag boy.
Oh, love it.
And, yeah. And so, yeah, it's been a great adventure. I've met so many people in the American government and now in the World War One Commission who are very interested in helping Americans see how vital World War One was and how courageous all those people were to volunteer, the women, the men, many of them. Yeah. Yeah. When
and
many
young,
of them had
just young and idealistic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So, 18, 19, 20.
Yeah. Well, let me mention real quick, you also write under the name Charisse Deland, and she writes wonderful eroticas, and her most recent, From the Seven Brides for Seven Seals, is No Getting Over You, is available now. So with about 30 seconds left in our interview here, what is your next project?
I have a new series, which is not erotica, but very sexy, because that's what I write. It's a new series called Those Notorious Americans, and it is about a family of an American robber baron who takes his family abroad to Europe in the 1870s and tries to marry them off to European
noblemen.
Yes. So the first one comes out October 30th. Yeah.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven
Productions.
www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.